Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. Episode 160, I'm Persuaded. This episode of Craftlit is brought to you by Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. And while you're at it, check out the catalog of all the new books you didn't know were waiting for you at knittingoutloud.com. Also, Holiday Travel and Craftlit take you to London, Bath, and Wales. There are a few seats left on our trip. Diane has just returned from casing the joint, as it were, and has come back with all sorts of beautiful pictures that she will be posting on the Twitter feed for the tour. Take a look and love them. Well, hello. As you know, we are going to be starting Persuasion today. And for those of you who are new to our podcast, please feel free to go by craftlit.com, where you can visit the library and get access to all of the previous episodes of Craftlit. Hi. So it's been a couple weeks since I talked to you. Lots of little things have been perking along here, but probably the most exciting is that Yarnagogo, that would be Rachel Heron in real life, she is releasing her first book. And so we had a little Skype chat.
Hello, my name is Rachel Heron, and I write the blog yarnagogo.com, and I'm very excited because my very first debut novel will be coming out on March 2nd, which is a week from right now when we are recording this, and it is called How to Knit a Love Song. And a little bit about it, it's about a knitter and a sheep rancher who get tossed together, and of course there are sparks, and the sheep rancher doesn't want the knitter on his land, and I like to say that they both need wool, but they certainly don't need it to generate heat because they create enough of their own.
Because so many of the people who listen also write, whether for publication or just for their own kind of journaling benefit. How long did it take you start to finish, from starting the novel to agent to publish to everything?
To everything, right now it's 2010, and I started this as a NaNoWriMo project in 2006. Yay! So that was, yeah, that was really exciting. It started as kind of a lark. I have a Master of Fine Arts in creative writing, so I was always trained in the high literature tradition, and this was more of a let me toss off something fun. And in tossing off something fun, I did the best writing I'd ever done because I relaxed a little bit and realized that good writing doesn't have to be so strenuous. And of course, after it became good, then it became really, really strenuous. And now it's the most strenuous writing I've ever done. But, so I wrote the first 50,000 words of it in a month, and then I put it away for probably about a year. I don't think I got it out for another year, and didn't finish it, until a blog reader of mine, reminded me that there was a contest coming up for a first novel. And so I quickly added some words to it and polished it up and put a slapdash ending on it and sent it off. And it did kind of well in that contest. And then I decided to really work on it and spent another few months working on that and then sent it out to look for an agent. And that took another 5 months or so of really sending out query letters. And, you know, that's no small process. And I feel like I've been so lucky in every part of it, from my agent to my editor at HarperCollins Avon to the whole team. They're all pulling for this book. And it's actually a series of three that is set in a fictional town called Cypress Hollow. So they're the Cypress Hollow Yarns.
Oh,
isn't that cute?
And when Rachel was talking about her team, she wasn't just talking about the editors. There's more behind writing a good book than I understood.
Romance Writers of America has been phenomenal. And I couldn't have done so much without my local chapter and without the national chapter. I just think that they are the best writing organization out there. I got more out of my last 2 years of being with those women, that group of mostly women, than I did out of a master's. I really believe that.
Did you join them before or after you got your agent? And
I joined them 3 days before I got my agent. I went to National Convention, which happened to be in San Francisco, which I had no idea what Romance Writers of America was. It just happened to be the National Convention in San Francisco. It moves around every year. And I decided, oh, that sounds like fun. I think I'll go check it out. My mind was completely blown by these intelligent, smart, savvy business. They know everything by this group of people. And that was Friday, Saturday, Sunday. The top of my head came off, and Susanna, my agent, called me on Monday morning and offered representation. And my life has never been the same.
But you're also on a blog.
Yeah, I'm actually with the Pens Fatales .com.
Love that name.
It's a great name, isn't it? And that's 8 women. There's we do 4 a week. We write on different themes. Last week it was love and romance. This week it's revenge, which is very hard for me. I didn't enjoy this week.
I liked your posting, though. I thought,
thank you.
Pretty much everybody who listens to Craftlit is going to feel exactly the same way.
We're not big on revenge. We do more with love and romance, I think, or with craft.
Right.
but those women are all, I've all met all through Romance Writers of America.
They have become
like a subsection of my Romance Writers of America group, and they have become my tightest friends. Those are the ones that I go to when I'm on the floor crying and I don't think I could ever write another word. I crawl over to the computer and send them a little email, and they tell me to put my butt back in the chair and keep writing.
So exciting. Now, okay, it's a set of 3.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first one that's out. You're working on, or you're done with and it's over with the editors for the second one?
The second one is pretty much done. I'm on what I hope will be my last round of editor revisions, and those are due in about 6 weeks. So those are pretty good, but the major revisions are done. And I love that book. That book just thrills me to my toes. I can't wait for that one to come out. That one will come out until probably the end of this year or beginning of next year. The date's not firm on that.
Okay.
And that one doesn't even really have a title yet, but it's going to be great. And then book 3 is up here. There's a lot of it on paper, but ever since I've been working on book 2, I know that book 3 has to change a lot. So it's always moving around in my mind.
Are you going to do the big blitzing marketing tour thing where you travel all over? And are you going to go teach knitting classes? And are you?
I hope I get to do a little bit of it. Stitches West is this coming weekend, and unfortunately the release of the book missed Stitches West by a few days, just by that much.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have a lot of excerpts, and I'm going to blitz Stitches West, and I've got signings in the Bay Area. I've got a couple of them up on Yarnagogo. I've got one signing in LA on March 21st. I've got a signing in Boise at the end of March, and I've got a signing in Columbus, Ohio, and in the end of April.
Name the bookstores if you can remember them, because...
Oh, sure.
Are all over.
Let's see. Knitter Studio is the one in LA on March 21st.
Cool.
And Bookshop West Portal is my launch party. That's March 16th. That's a Tuesday night. That's going to be really fun. I can't wait for that. Fuzz is the name of the yarn store in Boise on March 25th, I believe. And then I'm going to be at Romantic Times in Columbus, Ohio at the end of April. And at Romance Writers of America National, that'll be in Nashville in July. And then I'm hoping to get to some of the other conventions like Rhinebeck. I'd really love to get out there for a weekend. That would be wonderful. And I'm thinking about Stitches South in Atlanta.
So keep your eyes open for Rachel in your neighborhood, but also know that one of the jokes I've learned among professional writers is don't quit your day job. And in Rachel's case, we're all a lot safer having her have her day job.
Yeah. I'm a 911 dispatcher for fire medical.
Oh my God, the heroic person who has to listen to all the crazy people call you.
I used to listen to the crazy people when I did the police side of it. Yeah. Now I mostly listen to the people who need the immediate help of the, you know, CPR instructions, and or they're having a baby or something,
right?
You know, something really interesting, or their house is burning down. So
do you have any handy tips for people on, like, if you have to call 911, here's what not to do?
Don't slap the baby on the back if the baby's choking. That's normally a good suggestion. Although, you know, I'm not going to tell you, you know, don't quote me on that, because it might be the one time you need to. So don't sue me if it's the one time you need to hit. But that can sometimes force the food further in.
A lot of people
hit the babies on the back.
Oh my God. What should you do?
I don't know. I would say that normally you would call 911. If the baby's crying, they're getting air.
Great.
It's a good rule of, if they can make any noise, they're getting air. Take a deep breath yourself and call 911, and they'll tell you what to do.
Don't lose oxygen yourself.
Usually we can't hear what's going on in the house, because if the baby's choking on something, mom is screaming too loud for us to know what's going on.
What happens if you're the one who has a blocked airway and you're home alone? Can you just call and, like, whack the phone over and over, and someone will figure out that you're...
Yeah, I would say. And use a landline in that case. That's my number one advice for 911. Use a landline, because they will know your address then. If you use your cell phone, they're not going to know your address. They're going to know...
Even if you have GPS?
They're going to know an approximate location. So, and that's not always guaranteed. It's more of a 80 to 90% guess.
That's good information to get out there.
Yeah.
So I'm not crazy for wanting to have a landline.
No, and actually I got rid of, I don't know how it is in every state, but I know in my region you could check. I got rid of my landline here at home. However, the one thing I can't do is call 911. It's the only thing I can do, and my address and name is transmitted.
The things you learn from 911 dispatchers.
The tips you get. And every jurisdiction that you drive through regularly, have in your cell phone programmed the 7-digit emergency number. So every city that you go through, I go through 4 different cities to get to work. So I have, you know, all the different numbers to call for police and fire for those jurisdictions.
That's good to know.
Yeah, there. Yet another tip. You should write every day, and you should program in your 7-digit numbers.
Morning pages, 7-digit jurisdiction numbers.
Exactly.
What more do you need in life?
Life and death, people. It's a life and death. And on that note.
And then she's a knitter on top of this.
Exactly. Dispatcher,
knitter. It makes perfect sense.
Stress relief.
That's right. Can you knit while you're on the phone? Like,
yes,
you had mindless knitting?
Yeah, just mindless knitting. Mindless knitting, drop it when the phone rings, just kind of tap it. Tap out a few phrases and pick it up, drop it, pick it up, drop it.
How constant?
Yeah, a lot of dispatchers knit all across the country, you'll find.
I want that
it's
job.
One of those things. Yeah.
Oh my God. So not only is Rachel lucky, and we're so happy for her for getting a book out, gosh, it's like a gargantuan task to do. But she also has the perfect job. If she weren't so wonderful, it would be hard not to dislike her. But, you know, I'm feeling very Austin-oriented right now, so I'm very generous and forgiving. And I had the best time talking to her. She's just a kick in the pants. If you haven't visited her blog, please do. YarnaGoGo.com. You will find links to all of the sites that she mentioned from the show notes at craftlit.com. And like I said, I have a bunch of crafty news for you, but I'm saving it for next week because there's some other stuff that we needed to get to, mostly going by the name of persuasion. Oh, except there is one other thing that I wanted to mention to you. Jenny the Potter, who you know because I have spoken of her many times, Jenny the Potter, one of the most wonderful people in the world, her grandmother is doing poorly. And her attention span is short, but she loves to be read to. And Jenny would like to read fabulous short fiction to her grandmother. However, she's looking for fabulous short fiction for her grandmother. If you have any ideas, beloved short stories, long poems, anything that you think might be appropriate and wonderful and, you know, just spirit lifting. Jenny has started a new thread on the Ravelry Craftlit group. Please, if you have a chance, go there and give her some ideas. And if you can give her links to texts, so much the better. But it would be an enormous help to her and a lot of fun for all of us, because we're going to wind up with this fabulous compendium of short story ideas. Which reminds me, if you have written a short story, a poem, a pattern, a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker, anything like that that you would like to contribute to the iPhone application or iPhone iTouch, please send me an email, shoot me an email, let me know what you have, and we will hook it up on the website. Hunter's fabulous colophon pattern is now available in her Ravelry store. And you have through April and May to download and get a hold of the final two patterns that we have up on the website. The Hester Tea Cozy and Pearl Socks, which we have by button on the left-hand sidebar of the show notes. I also have made an I Listen button to Persuasion for you. So if you have a blog or a store or a website and you would like to show everyone the fabulous thing that you are listening to, I have not just the button on the show notes. This is in the right-hand show note, a little bit down. You will see underneath the button, the code for the button is there. By copying this code, you have to highlight and drag over it, and then it kind of slowly scrolls out and lets you collect all of the code. By taking the HTML code from there, you do two things. Not only do you take the URL for the image, which I'm giving to you, but you also get code that automatically links that image back to the Craftlit show notes, which makes it easier for people to track what you are doing and how you are, in fact, listening to Persuasion at Craftlit. So that's there for you, craftlit.com, Jenny the Potter, Ravelry, Craftlit Group, Story Thread, and yay, Rachel at Yarnagogo. So, Persuasion. Here's the thing. Oh, it's a very interesting book. And it's an interesting book because, you know, Craftlit started with Pride and Prejudice. And so, of course, you know, I have a soft spot in my heart for Jane Austen. But I was never really a Jane Austen scholar. I was just kind of an Anglophile, you know, who really liked Brit Lit. And so I read a lot of it. But I didn't ever spend a whole lot of time really heavily researching Jane Austen. Well, I have a few tidbits. For those of you who haven't listened to Pride and Prejudice, you might actually want to go back and pick up the first 20 episodes of Craftlit, where we did Pride and Prejudice, and then flip over here, because it'll be interesting. Because Pride and Prejudice was one of her earlier books, written, I think, around the time she turned 25. I need to go look at the timeline again, but it was one of her earlier books. And this one, Persuasion, was the book she was writing the year that she died. And I think there are some things in this book that make me wonder if she wouldn't have gone back in and revised again if she hadn't passed away so young. She was, what, 40-something? Way too young, says the 42-year-old. So, interesting stuff. She was the second to the last of 8 children, all boys, and then she and her sister at the end. It appears that her family was a happy one. She was certainly very close to her sister. And a lot of what we know about her as a person come from letters that she wrote back and forth with her sister Cassandra. She, her father was a clergyman, but he came from a very, you know, middle-class gentleman farmer family, evidently married up. So there was, you know, some talk within his wife's home about whether she had married down, because I guess if he's going to marry up, someone had to marry down. But it's clear that, you know, that number one, we know that was a topic of conversation at this time. And number two, it seems that that was a topic of conversation that Jane was pretty aware of. All of that being said, though, even though she and her sister never married, it turns out, I was reading around, because it was so difficult to find a suitable match within your class, that kind of, you know, narrow swath of people that you had available to you, the estimate is somewhere between 10 and 35% of eligible women didn't marry at all. Jane seems to have been unperturbed by this for the most part, even though all of her books certainly focus on this. in Mansfield Park, it seems very clear that one of the reasons that her books focus on these kinds of stories, you know, the finding a match stories, it's a number of things. Number one, her books were written by a woman and written for women. Number two, this was kind of the pulp fiction of the time. I mean, reading fiction at all was kind of, you know, so déclassé, because if you were really going to read and be literate, you would be, you know, reading the histories of the War of the Roses and stuff like that. Fiction was just beyond the pale. And of course, this is when Frankenstein is starting to come out and the romantic writers are still writing poetry for the most part, which was acceptable. But fiction, you know, one simply didn't talk about the fiction that they were reading. You did it, but you didn't talk about it. So she's kind of writing pulp fiction of the time, the same way that Joe in Little Women was writing kind of trashy stuff. Maybe better trash, good trash, but still kind of trashy stuff. Well, we can look back now and see that Austen certainly stands out from the crowd, probably because of what you are going to see so clearly in Persuasion. In Pride and Prejudice, a lot of Austen's wry sense of humor was aimed at Mrs. Bennet, and it stayed within the household, or at least within the family, because, of course, she also did make fun of the cousin, the clergyman who would come to call and who eventually married her friend. Here, Austen, an older and wiser and perhaps less inhibited, more unafraid of censure, goes out of her class and does not make fun of the middle class. She is pointing a finger, and she's doing a very good job, at the landed gentry. The main character who you will hear her make fun of, Sir Walter Elliot, he is a baronet, which is above a knight but below a baron. And so it's important to know that he's kind of in that neutral zone between the two. But he's far enough up to feel completely comfortable trashing anyone who isn't his rank or higher. So Austen is taking a bold step outside of her own class band, and she is just, you know, with her rapier wit, skewering vain, self-important, pompous jerks. And not like there aren't plenty of them today for us to make fun of, but it's a special kind of fun, I find, listening to an Austen book. So in this first chapter, there's not a lot beyond exposition. You know, it's the, hello, no, I'm sorry, Mr. Exposition isn't home right now. No, he's skiing in the Alps. It's the same kind of thing, although I posit that Austen's device that she uses in this first chapter of Persuasion is one of the best that I have come across, because not only do we get exposition about who we are about to meet, but before we even get past the first couple of pages of the book, we know who we're about to meet intimately. We have a very clear picture in our mind very early on of the type of people we're about to meet. We get a little bit of their history, sure, but we really get a wonderful kind of a painting in full technicolor of the personalities that we are going to be mixed in with for the rest of the book. So I'm going to go ahead and play chapter one for you right now, and then come back for chapter two.
Chapter one of Persuasion. This is the LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Karen Savage. Persuasion by Jane Austen. Chapter one. Sir Walter Elliot of Kellynch Hall in Somersetshire was a man who, for his own amusement, never took up any book but the Baronetage. There he found occupation for an idle hour, and consolation in a distressed one. There his faculties were roused into admiration and respect by contemplating the limited remnant of the earliest patents. There, any unwelcome sensations arising from domestic affairs changed naturally into pity and contempt as he turned over the almost endless creations of the last century. And there, if every other leaf were powerless, he could read his own history with an interest which never failed. This was the page at which the favourite volume always opened. Eliot of Kellynch Hall. Walter Eliot, born March 1, 1760. Married July 15, 1784, Elizabeth, daughter of James Stevenson, Esquire of South Park in the county of Gloucester, by which lady, who died 1800, he has issue Elizabeth, born June 1, 1785, Anne, born August 9, 1787, a stillborn son, November 5, 1789, Mary, born November 20, 1791. Precisely such had the paragraph originally stood from the printer's hands, but Sir Walter had improved it by adding, for the information of himself and his family, these words, after the date of Mary's birth. Married December 16, 1810, Charles, son and heir of Charles Musgrove, Esquire of Uppercross, in the county of Somerset, and by inserting most accurately the day of the month on which he had lost his wife. Then followed the history and rise of the ancient and respectable family in the usual terms. How it had been first settled in Cheshire, how mentioned in Dugdale, serving the office of High Sheriff, representing a borough in three successive parliaments, exertions of loyalty and dignity of baronet in the first year of Charles II, with all the Marys and Elizabeths they had married, forming altogether two handsome duodecimo pages, and concluding with the arms and motto, principal seat Kellynch Hall in the county of Somerset, and Sir Walter's handwriting again in this finale. Heir presumptive, William Walter Elliot Esquire, great-grandson of the second Sir Walter. Vanity was the beginning and the end of Sir Walter Elliot's character, vanity of person and of situation. He had been remarkably handsome in his youth, and at 54 was still a very fine man. Few women could think more of their personal appearance than he did, nor could the valet of any new-made lord be more delighted with the place he held in society. He considered the blessing of beauty as inferior only to the blessing of a baronetcy, and the Sir Walter Elliot, who united these gifts, was the constant object of his warmest respect and devotion. His good looks and his rank had one fair claim on his attachment, since to them he must have owed a wife of very superior character to anything deserved by his own. Lady Elliot had been an excellent woman, sensible and amiable, whose judgment and conduct, if they might be pardoned the youthful infatuation which made her Lady Elliot, had never required indulgence afterwards. She had humoured, or softened, or concealed his failings, and promoted his real respectability for 17 years, and though not the very happiest being in the world herself, had found enough in her duties, her friends, and her children to attach her to life and make it no matter of indifference to her when she was called on to quit them. Three girls, the two eldest 16 and 14, was an awful legacy for a mother to bequeath, an awful charge, rather, to confide to the authority and guidance of a conceited, silly father. She had, however, one very intimate friend, a sensible, deserving woman who had been brought by strong attachment to herself to settle close by her in the village of Kellynch, and on her kindness and advice Lady Elliot mainly relied for the best help and maintenance of the good principles and instruction which she had been anxiously giving her daughters. This friend and Sir Walter did not marry, whatever might have been anticipated on that head by their acquaintance. 13 years had passed away since Lady Elliot's death, and they were still near neighbours and intimate friends, and one remained a widower, the other a widow. That Lady Russell, of steady age and character and extremely well provided for, should have no thought of a second marriage, needs no apology to the public, which is rather apt to be unreasonably discontented when a woman does marry again than when she does not. But Sir Walter's continuing singleness requires explanation. Be it known, then, that Sir Walter, like a good father, having met with one or two private disappointments in very unreasonable applications, prided himself on remaining single for his dear daughter's sake. For one daughter, his eldest, he would really have given up anything which he had not been very much tempted to do. Elizabeth had succeeded at 16 to all that was possible of her mother's rights and consequence, and being very handsome and very like himself, her influence had always been great, and they had got on together most happily. His two other children were of very inferior value. Mary had acquired a little artificial importance by becoming Mrs. Charles Musgrove, but Anne, with an elegance of mind and sweetness of character which must have placed her high with any people of real understanding, was nobody with either father or sister. Her word had no weight, her convenience was always to give way. She was only Anne. To Lady Russell, indeed, she was a most dear and highly valued goddaughter, favourite, and friend. Lady Russell loved them all, but it was only in Anne that she could fancy the mother to revive again. A few years before, Anne Elliot had been a very pretty girl, but her bloom had vanished early, and as even in its height her father had found little to admire in her, so totally different were her delicate features and mild dark eyes from his own, there could be nothing in them now that she was faded and thin to excite his esteem. He had never indulged much hope, he had now none, of ever reading her name in any other page of his favourite work. All equality of alliance must rest with Elizabeth, for Mary had merely connected herself with an old country family of respectability and large fortune, and had therefore given all the honour and received none. Elizabeth would, one day or other, marry suitably. It sometimes happens that a woman is handsomer at 29 than she was 10 years before, and generally speaking, if there has been neither ill health nor anxiety, it is a time of life at which scarcely any charm is lost. It was so with Elizabeth, still the same handsome Miss Elliot that she had begun to be 13 years ago, and Sir Walter might be excused, therefore, in forgetting her age, or at least be deemed only half a fool for thinking himself and Elizabeth as blooming as ever amidst the wreck of the good looks of everybody else, for he could plainly see how old all the rest of his family and acquaintance were growing. Anne haggard, Mary coarse, every face in the neighbourhood worsting, and the rapid increase of the crow's foot about Lady Russell's temples had long been a distress to him. Elizabeth did not quite equal her father in personal contentment. 13 years had seen her mistress of Kellynch Hall, presiding and directing with a self-possession and decision which could never have given the idea of her being younger than she was. For 13 years she had been doing the honours, and laying down the domestic law at home, and leading the way to the chaise and four, and walking immediately after Lady Russell out of all the drawing-rooms and dining-rooms in the country. 13 winters' revolving frosts had seen her opening every ball of credit which a scanty neighbourhood afforded, and 13 springs shone their blossoms as she travelled up to London with her father for a few weeks' annual enjoyment of the great world. She had the remembrance of all this. She had the consciousness of being 29 to give her some regrets and some apprehensions. She was fully satisfied of being still quite as handsome as ever, but she felt her approach to the years of danger, and would have rejoiced to be certain of being properly solicited by Baronet Blood within the next 12 months or two. Then might she again take up the book of books with as much enjoyment as in her early youth, but now she liked it not. Always to be presented with the date of her own birth and see no marriage follow but that of a youngest sister made the book an evil, and more than once, when her father had left it open on the table near her, had she closed it with averted eyes and pushed it away. She had had a disappointment, moreover, which that book, and especially the history of her own family, must ever present the remembrance of. The heir presumptive, the very William Walter Elliot Esquire, whose rights had been so generously supported by her father, had disappointed her. She had, while a very young girl, as soon as she had known him to be, in the event of her having no brother, the future baronet, meant to marry him, and her father had always meant that she should. He had not been known to them as a boy, but soon after Lady Elliot's death, Sir Walter had sought the acquaintance, and though his overtures had not been met with any warmth, he had persevered in seeking it, making allowances for the modest drawing back of youth. And in one of their spring excursions to London, when Elizabeth was in her first bloom, Mr. Elliot had been forced into the introduction. He was at that time a very young man, just engaged in the study of law, and Elizabeth found him extremely agreeable, and every plan in his favour was confirmed. He was invited to Kellynch Hall, he was talked of and expected all the rest of the year, but he never came. The following spring he was seen again in town, found equally agreeable, again encouraged, invited and expected, and again he did not come. And the next tidings were that he was married. Instead of pushing his fortune in the line marked out for the heir of the House of Elliot, he had purchased independence by uniting himself to a rich woman of inferior birth. Sir Walter had resented it. As the head of the house, he felt that he ought to have been consulted, especially after taking the young man so publicly by the hand. For they must have been seen together, he observed, once at Tattersall's, and twice in the lobby of the House of Commons. His disapprobation was expressed, but apparently very little regarded. Mr. Elliot had attempted no apology, and shown himself as unsolicitous of being longer noticed by the family, as Sir Walter considered him unworthy of it. All acquaintance between them had ceased. This very awkward history of Mr. Elliot was still, after an interval of several years, felt with anger by Elizabeth, who had liked the man for himself, and still more for being her father's heir, and whose strong family pride could see only in him a proper match for Sir Walter Elliot's eldest daughter. There was not a baronet from A to Z whom her feelings could have so willingly acknowledged as an equal. Yet so miserably had he conducted himself, that though she was at this present time, the summer of 1814, wearing black ribbons for his wife, she could not admit him to be worth thinking of again. The disgrace of his first marriage might, perhaps, as there was no reason to suppose it perpetuated by offspring, have been got over, had he not done worse. But he had, as by the customary intervention of kind friends they had been informed, spoken most disrespectfully of them all, most slightingly and contemptuously of the very blood he belonged to, and the honours which were hereafter to be his own. This could not be pardoned. Such were Elizabeth Elliot's sentiments and sensations, such the cares to alloy, the agitations to vary, the sameness and the elegance, the prosperity and the nothingness of her scene of life, such the feelings to give interest to a long, uneventful residence in one country circle, to fill the vacancies which there were no habits of utility abroad, no talents or accomplishments for home to occupy. But now another occupation and solicitude of mind was beginning to be added to these. Her father was growing distressed for money. She knew that when he now took up the baronetage, it was to drive the heavy bills of his tradespeople and the unwelcome hints of Mr. Shepherd, his agents, from his thought. The Kellynch property was good, but not equal to Sir Walter's apprehension of the state required in its possessor. While Lady Elliot lived, there had been method, moderation, and economy, which had just kept him within his income. But with her had died all such right-mindedness, and from that period he had been constantly exceeding it. It had not been possible for him to spend less. He had done nothing but what Sir Walter Elliot was imperiously called on to do. But blameless as he was not only growing dreadfully in debt, but was hearing of it so often that it became vain to attempt concealing it longer, even partially, from his daughter. He had given her some hints of it the last spring in town. He had gone so far even as to say, "Can we retrench? Does it occur to you that there is any one article in which we can retrench?" And Elizabeth, to do her justice, had, in the first ardour of female alarm, set seriously to think what could be done, and had finally proposed these two branches of economy: to cut off some unnecessary charities, and to refrain from new furnishing the drawing-room, to which expedients she afterwards added the happy thought of their taking no present down to Anne, as had been the usual yearly custom. But these measures, however good in themselves, were insufficient for the real extent of the evil, the whole of which Sir Walter found himself obliged to confess to her soon afterwards. Elizabeth had nothing to propose of deeper efficacy. She felt herself ill-used and unfortunate, as did her father, and they were neither of them able to devise any means of lessening their expenses without compromising their dignity or relinquishing their comforts in a way not to be borne. There was only a small part of his estate that Sir Walter could dispose of, but had every acre been alienable, it would have made no difference. He had condescended to mortgage as far as he had the power, but he would never condescend to sell. No, he would never disgrace his name so far. The Kellynch estate should be transmitted whole and entire, as he had received it. Their two confidential friends, Mr. Shepherd, who lived in the neighbouring market town, and Lady Russell, were called to advise them, and both father and daughter seemed to expect that something should be struck out by one or the other to remove their embarrassments and reduce their expenditure, without involving the loss of any indulgence of taste or pride. End of chapter 1.
Okay, so chapter 2. Here's some things to listen for. A couple of words that I want to make sure you are comfortable with. First, one of the words that Austen is using in its original, or for us, archaic usage, is apprehension. To apprehend something, or apprehension of, it's like grasping something, like, oh, I get it. You apprehend something, you understand it, you get it. Retrench is kind of another word for digging back in and pulling it all together and kind of starting over again. And as we head into chapter 2, there's another thing you need to know. This is the era, one of the many eras, actually, of the British Navy at its peak. I mean, we certainly had, you know, with Francis Drake, pirate though he may have been, Sir Francis Drake and Queen Elizabeth, you certainly saw the primacy of the British naval fleet out there sinking the Spanish Armada. But then you get Nelson, you know, Lord Admiral Nelson. You get Nelson. Nelson's out there doing all sorts of fun things. And in fact, we just watched the movie Dam Busters, where they find a way to skip a bomb along a body of water, like a lake, and get it to run up against a dam and then sink down until the point at which the pressure is hard enough and it blows up the bomb. And that was how they stopped the Nazi steel factories in the war. At the end of the movie, they go to the scientist and say, wow, you know, you're such a genius. How'd you ever get this idea? And he said, well, actually, it was Admiral Nelson. I was thinking, oh, Nelson? Why, that's the same time. So everything comes full circle. But the Navy at this point, and again, this is later than Pride and Prejudice was written. This is considerably later than Pride and Prejudice was written. The Navy has been out there doing its job, and a position in the Navy is a respected one. And you will hear more than once characters in this book waxing rhapsodic about Navy men, Navy positions, the work that the Navy does, all that kind of stuff. So those are things to listen for. The other thing is, there is a character to listen for. And this struck me as rather odd because everything is just understood. And it's not so clearly understood for us in today's world. There is a character named Mrs. Clay. She's young. She was married. She has two small children. The marriage didn't work out, and that's all that's said about it. But there's something inappropriate about her being in the Elliot home. There are a couple reasons why it's inappropriate. One, she's a divorcee. Two, she has children who do not seem to be with her when she is visiting. Three, she's hanging out with an unmarried woman. And four, there is an unmarried adult male, the father, in the house. And there are implications that she's looking to hook up with the father, as well as implications that she could somehow kind of look or reflect poorly on the unmarried sister. So there's a lot of subtext going on around Mrs. Clay, and you're going to hear this over and over and over again throughout the novel. And so just kind of file it away as a, oh, I get it, that's what's going on thing. Because it's really, until the very end of the book, it's not going to be spoken of in any great detail. And then there's Mrs. Russell, or Lady Russell, and we will be hearing more about Lady Russell in Chapter 3. So here is Chapter 2.
Chapter 2 of Persuasion. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Karen Savage. Persuasion by Jane Austen. Chapter 2. Mr. Shepherd, a civil, cautious lawyer, who, whatever might be his hold or his views on Sir Walter, would rather have the disagreeable prompted by anybody else, excused himself from offering the slightest hint, and only begged leave to recommend an implicit reference to the excellent judgment of Lady Russell, from whose known good sense he fully expected to have just such resolute measures advised as he meant to see finally adopted. Lady Russell was most anxiously zealous on the subject, and gave it much serious consideration. She was a woman rather of sound than of quick abilities, whose difficulties in coming to any decision in this instance were great, from the opposition of two leading principles. She was of strict integrity herself, with a delicate sense of honour, but she was as desirous of saving Sir Walter's feelings, as solicitous for the credit of the family, as aristocratic in her ideas of what was due to them as anybody of sense and honesty could well be. She was a benevolent, charitable, good woman, and capable of strong attachments, most correct in her conduct, strict in her notions of decorum, and with manners that were held a standard of good breeding. She had a cultivated mind, and was, generally speaking, rational and consistent. But she had prejudices on the side of ancestry. She had a value for rank and consequence, which blinded her a little to the faults of those who possessed them. Herself the widow of only a knight, she gave the dignity of a baronet all its due. And Sir Walter, independent of his claims as an old acquaintance, an attentive neighbour, an obliging landlord, the husband of her very dear friend, the father of Anne and her sisters, was, as being Sir Walter, in her apprehension, entitled to a great deal of compassion and consideration under his present difficulties. They must retrench. That did not admit of a doubt. But she was very anxious to have it done with the least possible pain to him and Elizabeth. She drew up plans of economy, She made exact calculations, and she did what nobody else thought of doing. She consulted Anne, who never seemed considered by the others as having any interest in the question. She consulted, and in a degree was influenced by her in marking out the scheme of retrenchment which was at last submitted to Sir Walter. Every emendation of Anne's had been on the side of honesty against importance. She wanted more vigorous measures, a more complete reformation, a quicker release from debt, a much higher tone of indifference for anything but justice and equity. "If we can persuade your father to all this," said Lady Russell, looking over her paper, "much may be done. If he will adopt these regulations, in 7 years he will be clear, and I hope we may be able to convince him and Elizabeth that Kellynch Hall has a respectability in itself which cannot be affected by these reductions, and that the true dignity of Sir Walter Elliot will be very far from lessened in the eyes of sensible people by acting like a man of principle. What will he be doing, in fact, but what very many of our first families have done, or ought to do? There will be nothing singular in his case, and it is singularity which often makes the worst part of our suffering, as it always does of our conduct. I have great hope of prevailing. We must be serious and decided, for after all, the person who has contracted debts must pay them, and though a great deal is due to the feelings of the gentleman and the head of a house, like your father, there is still more due to the character of an honest man." This was the principle on which Anne wanted her father to be proceeding, his friends to be urging him. She considered it as an act of indispensable duty to clear away the claims of creditors with all the expedition which the most comprehensive retrenchments could secure, and saw no dignity in anything short of it. She wanted it to be prescribed and felt as a duty. She rated Lady Russell's influence highly, and as to the severe degree of self-denial which her own conscience prompted, she believed there might be little more difficulty in persuading them to a complete than to half a reformation. Her knowledge of her father and Elizabeth inclined her to think that the sacrifice of one pair of horses would be hardly less painful than of both, and so on, through the whole list of Lady Russell's too gentle reductions. How Anne's more rigid requisitions might have been taken is of little consequence. Lady Russell's had no success at all. Could not be put up with, were not to be borne. What? Every comfort of life knocked off. Journeys, London, servants, horses, table, contractions and restrictions everywhere. To live no longer with the decencies even of a private gentleman. No, he would sooner quit Kellynch Hall at once than remain in it on such disgraceful terms. Quit Kellynch Hall. The hint was immediately taken up by Mr. Shepherd, whose interest was involved in the reality of Sir Walter's retrenching, and who was perfectly persuaded that nothing would be done without a change of abode. Since the idea had been started in the very quarter which ought to dictate, he had no scruple, he said, in confessing his judgment to be entirely on that side. It did not appear to him that Sir Walter could materially alter his style of living in a house which had such a character of hospitality and ancient dignity to support. In any other place, Sir Walter might judge for himself, and would be looked up to as regulating the modes of life in whatever way he might choose to model his household. Sir Walter would quit Kellynch Hall, and after a very few days more of doubt and indecision, the great question of whither he should go was settled, and the first outline of this important change made out. There had been three alternatives: London, Bath, or another house in the country. All Anne's wishes had been for the latter. A small house in their own neighbourhood, where they might still have Lady Russell's society, still be near Mary, and still have the pleasure of sometimes seeing the lawns and groves of Kellynch, was the object of her ambition. But the usual fate of Anne attended her, in having something very opposite from her inclination fixed on. She disliked Bath, and did not think it agreed with her, and Bath was to be her home. Sir Walter had at first thought more of London. But Mr. Shepherd felt that he could not be trusted in London, and had been skilful enough to dissuade him from it, and make Bath preferred. It was a much safer place for a gentleman in his predicament. He might there be important at comparatively little expense. Two material advantages of Bath over London had of course been given all their weight. Its more convenient distance from Kellynch, only 50 miles, and Lady Russell spending some part of every winter there. And to the very great satisfaction of Lady Russell, whose first views on the projected change had been for Bath, Sir Walter and Elizabeth were induced to believe that they should lose neither consequence nor enjoyment by settling there. Lady Russell felt obliged to oppose her dear Anne's known wishes. It would be too much to expect Sir Walter to descend into a small house in his own neighbourhood. Anne herself would have found the mortifications of it more than she foresaw, and to Sir Walter's feelings they must have been dreadful. And with regard to Anne's dislike of Bath, she considered it as a prejudice and mistake arising first from the circumstance of her having been 3 years at school there, after her mother's death, and secondly, from her happening to be not in perfectly good spirits the only winter which she had afterwards spent there with herself. Lady Russell was fond of Bath, in short, and disposed to think it must suit them all. And as to her young friend's health, by passing all the warm months with her at Kellynch Lodge, every danger would be avoided. And it was, in fact, a change which must do both health and spirits good. Anne had been too little from home, too little seen. Her spirits were not high. A larger society would improve them. She wanted her to be more known. The undesirableness of any other house in the same neighbourhood for Sir Walter was certainly much strengthened by one part, and a very material part of the scheme, which had been happily engrafted on the beginning. He was not only to quit his home, but to see it in the hands of others, a trial of fortitude which stronger heads than Sir Walter's have found too much. Kellynch Hall was to be let. This, however, was a profound secret, not to be breathed beyond their own circle. Sir Walter could not have borne the degradation of being known to design letting his house. Mr. Shepherd had once mentioned the word advertise, but never dared approach it again. Sir Walter spurned the idea of its being offered in any manner, forbade the slightest hint being dropped of his having such an intention, and it was only on the supposition of his being spontaneously solicited by some most unexceptionable applicant, on his own terms, and as a great favour, that he would let it at all. How quick come the reasons for approving what we like! Lady Russell had another excellent one at hand, for being extremely glad that Sir Walter and his family were to remove from the country. Elizabeth had been lately forming an intimacy which she wished to see interrupted. It was with the daughter of Mr. Shepherd, who had returned, after an unprosperous marriage, to her father's house, with the additional burden of two children. She was a clever young woman, who understood the art of pleasing, the art of pleasing, at least, at Kellynch Hall, and who made herself so acceptable to Miss Elliot as to have been already staying there more than once, in spite of all that Lady Russell, who thought it a friendship quite out of place, could hint of caution and reserve. Lady Russell, indeed, had scarcely any influence with Elizabeth, and seemed to love her rather because she would love her than because Elizabeth deserved it. She had never received from her more than outward attention, nothing beyond the observances of complaisance, had never succeeded in any point which she wanted to carry against previous inclination. She had been repeatedly very earnest in trying to get Anne included in the visit to London, sensibly open to all the injustice and all the discredit of the selfish arrangements which shut her out, and on many lesser occasions had endeavoured to give Elizabeth the advantage of her own better judgment and experience, but always in vain. Elizabeth would go her own way. And never had she pursued it in more decided opposition to Lady Russell than in this selection of Mrs. Clay. Turning from the society of so deserving a sister to bestow her affection and confidence on one who ought to have been nothing to her but the object of distant civility. From situation, Mrs. Clay was, in Lady Russell's estimate, a very unequal, and in her character, she believed, a very dangerous companion. And a removal that would leave Mrs. Clay behind, and bring a choice of more suitable intimates within Miss Elliot's reach, was therefore an object of first-rate importance. End of chapter 2.
So, after these first couple of chapters, obviously, one of the ways that Jane Austen has wormed her way into our hearts is by having characters like Mrs. Bennet, or in this case, Sir Walter, who are just ridiculous, and it's very fun for us to poke fun at them. Again, though, this is Austen leaving her class. She is poking fun at someone above her, class-wise, which I think is quite a brave move. But she's not making fun of his situation. She's not making fun of the fact that they have been living in debt and running out of money. This is, you know, the Industrial Revolution did some really strange things to time-honored and time-worn habits of kind of, you know, feudal society where you have people who own land and people who work the land and people who aren't lucky enough to do either. And this was not, what Sir Walter is going through is not uncommon at this time for people who are property owners. I think probably not unlike what we have seen worldwide lately. You know, at the beginning of an economic downturn, there is the initial oh, well, things are going to get better. So, you know, just keep living the way you live. And after a while, you realize now things haven't turned around and now you're in debt. And now things really do have to change on a very serious level. And you know what he's been persuaded to do? There's a lot of persuading in this book. What he's been persuaded to do is to downsize in a fairly significant way. He's going to lease out the family estate and move to Bath. Now, Jane Austen doesn't like Bath very much in real life. She did spend some time there. It was not the happiest time of her life. As we get into the book more, you'll start to understand where Austen's feelings towards Bath come in. But it was a huge metropolitan hub at the time. It continues to be a huge metropolitan hub. I mean, it is, you know, exploded by population compared to when Jane Austen was there. But when you consider living horse and carriage and non-electric, it was a pretty major place. I think there were, 35,000 people living there? I'm going to have to check on the number, but it was a ton of people. So it was a bustling kind of place. It also is, if you've never been there before, Bath sits at the bottom of a small valley, as I recall. I mean, I haven't looked at a topographical map of this, but I'm going from my memory from, oh dear, it's 21 years ago. It's at the bottom of a small valley. And because of that, you get weather inversions. If you've ever lived any place that's in a valley, you know that you kind of get your own weather there. This was true for Bath. And if you remember what we talked about with Jekyll and Hyde, with coal fires, and, well, any fires of any sort, you're going to get this weird inversion layer where the air pressure literally kind of puts a lid on the air pollution and tamps it down on top of you. This is what happens in Southern California in the Inland Empire, where I grew up. Los Angeles, all of their smog blew over to us, and it would sit on us for days. And in the summertime, if you tried to go swimming, you would get what we call smog-logged, not waterlogged, smog-logged. You go swimming for an hour, and your lungs would ache. I haven't had this feeling in decades, and still the memory is so vivid of how horrible this was, trying to do any kind of physical exertion in this inversion layer climate with any kind of pollution. And coal smoke would have been just as bad, huge particulate matter, and you'd be coughing it up for days. So Bath is going to be an interesting place for us to go because Jane Austen is ambivalent about it, but Sir Walter and Lady Russell and Elizabeth have all agreed that they love it. So something interesting is going to happen there. All right, I think that's enough. We have time to move on to chapter 3. It's going to make the podcast a little long, but I really want to get to chapter 3 because some very important people are going to be introduced to us. Oh, somebody went by really quickly, and I need to draw your attention to him. This is the other Elliot. He is mentioned at the end of chapter 1, and I'm sorry I didn't catch it before, but I want to go back and pick it up. He's mentioned as someone who paid attention to Elizabeth, and they thought that things were going to go well. This is Mr. William Elliot. He is the heir to the estate, so he's going to get Kellynch Hall eventually. And then, you know, they invited him out to the house, and everything looks great, and then he doesn't show, and he doesn't show, and he doesn't show, and he doesn't show. And oh, he's married. And he's married to a rich woman, not a titled woman. Not a landed woman, but a rich one. And so everybody's shocked and horrified. And then they hear that he's been trashing the family behind their back. So that's just going to lie fallow for a while. But you need to remember that he exists. And you need to remember that those are the things that surrounded his history with the Elliot family thus far. Okay, so Mr. Shepherd, the lawyer, chapter 3. Mr. Shepherd is a wonderful character, because even though, you know, he's a gentleman as far as behavior goes, but he is simply Mr. Shepherd. And of course he has a job because he is a lawyer, and he's going to take care of all of this. And they do such a beautiful job again of persuasion in this chapter. It's you know, this graceful dance of discussing how one could let the home to someone else, and perhaps who one could let the home to without losing face. Beautiful work happens, and this is when you start to hear more and more about the Navy. But there is someone who gets mentioned in this chapter, a Mr. Wentworth. Pay attention to how everyone responds or doesn't to the comment about a Mr. Wentworth. And that is going to be where we end this beginning of Persuasion, because once you hear this chapter, you will have all the main players in place and you'll be ready to go. So here we go with Chapter 3 of Persuasion.
Chapter 3 of Persuasion. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Karen Savage. Persuasion by Jane Austen. Chapter 3. "I must take leave to observe, Sir Walter," said Mr. Shepherd one morning at Kellynch Hall, as he laid down the newspaper, "that the present juncture is much in our favour. This peace will be turning all our rich naval officers ashore. They will be all wanting a home. Could not be a better time, Sir Walter, for having a choice of tenants, very responsible tenants. Many a noble fortune has been made during the war. If a rich admiral were to come in our way, Sir Walter—" "He would be a very lucky man, Shepherd," replied Sir Walter. "That's all I have to remark. A prize indeed would Kellynch Hall be to him. Rather the greatest prize of all, let him have taken ever so many before. Hey, Shepherd?" Mr. Shepherd laughed, as he knew he must, at this wit, and then added, "I presume to observe, Sir Walter, that in the way of business, gentlemen of the Navy are well to deal with. I have had a little knowledge of their methods of doing business, and I am free to confess that they have very liberal notions, and are as likely to make desirable tenants as any set of people one should meet with. Therefore, Sir Walter, what I would take leave to suggest is, that if in consequence of any rumours getting abroad of your intention, which must be contemplated as a possible thing, because we know how difficult it is to keep the actions and designs of one part of the world from the notice and curiosity of the other, consequence has its tax. I, John Shepherd, might conceal any family matters that I chose, for nobody would think it worth their while to observe me. But Sir Walter Elliot has eyes upon him, which it may be very difficult to elude, and therefore, thus might I venture upon, that it will not greatly surprise me if, with all our caution, some rumour of the truth should get abroad, in the supposition of which, as I was going to observe, since applications will unquestionably follow, I should think any from our wealthy naval commanders particularly worth attending to, and beg leave to add that 2 hours will bring me over at any time, to save you the trouble of replying." Sir Walter only nodded. But soon afterwards, rising and pacing the room, he observed sarcastically, "There are few among the gentlemen of the Navy, I imagine, who would not be surprised to find themselves in a house of this description." "They would look around them, no doubt, and bless their good fortune," said Mrs. Clay, for Mrs. Clay was present. Her father had driven her over, nothing being of so much use to Mrs. Clay's health as a drive to Kellynch. "But I quite agree with my father in thinking a sailor might be a very desirable tenant. I have known a good deal of the profession, and besides their liberality, they are so neat and careful in all their ways. These valuable pictures of yours, Sir Walter, if you chose to leave them, would be perfectly safe. Everything in and about the house would be taken such excellent care of. The gardens and shrubberies would be kept in almost as high order as they are now. You need not be afraid, Miss Elliot, of your own sweet flower gardens being neglected." "As to all that," rejoined Sir Walter coolly, "supposing I were induced to let my house, I have by no means made up my mind as to the privileges to be annexed to it. I am not particularly disposed to favour a tenant. The park would be open to him, of course, and few Navy officers or men of any other description can have had such a range. But what restrictions I might impose on the use of the pleasure grounds is another thing. I am not fond of the idea of my shrubberies being always approachable, and I should recommend Miss Elliot to be on her guard with respect to her flower garden. I am very little disposed to grant a tenant of Kellynch Hall any extraordinary favour, I assure you, be he sailor or soldier." After a short pause, Mr. Shepherd presumed to say, "In all these cases there are established usages which make everything plain and easy between landlord and tenant. Your interest, Sir Walter, is in pretty safe hands. Depend upon me for taking care that no tenant has more than his just rights. I venture to hint that Sir Walter Elliot cannot be half so jealous for his own as John Shepherd will be for him." Here Anne spoke. The Navy, I think, who have done so much for us, have at least an equal claim with any other set of men, for all the comforts and all the privileges which any home can give. Sailors work hard enough for their comforts, we must all allow. Very true, very true. What Miss Anne says is very true, was Mr. Shepherd's rejoinder. And, oh, certainly, was his daughter's. But Sir Walter's remark was, soon afterwards, the profession has its utility, but I should be sorry to see any friend of mine belonging to it. Indeed, was the reply, and with a look of surprise. Yes, it is in two points offensive to me. I have two strong grounds of objection to it. First, as being the means of bringing persons of obscure birth into undue distinction, and raising men to honours which their fathers and grandfathers never dreamt of. And secondly, as it cuts up a man's youth and vigour most horribly. A sailor grows old sooner than any other man. I have observed it all my life. A man is in greater danger in the Navy of being insulted by the rise of one whose father his father might have disdained to speak to, and of becoming prematurely an object of disgust himself, than in any other line. One day last spring in town I was in company with two men, striking instances of what I am talking of. Lord St. Ives, whose father we all know to have been a country curate, without bread to eat. I was to give place to Lord St. Ives and a certain Admiral Baldwin, the most deplorable-looking personage you can imagine. His face the colour of mahogany, rough and rugged to the last degree, all lines and wrinkles, nine grey hairs of a side, and nothing but a dab of powder at the top. In the name of heaven, who is that old fellow? Said I to a friend of mine who was standing near, Sir Basil Morley. Old fellow, cried Sir Basil, it is Admiral Baldwin. What do you take his age to be? 60, said I, or perhaps 62. 40, replied Sir Basil, 40 and no more. Picture to yourselves my amazement. I shall not easily forget Admiral Baldwin. I never saw quite so wretched an example of what a seafaring life can do. But to a degree I know it is the same with them all. They are all knocked about, and exposed to every climate and every weather, till they are not fit to be seen. It is a pity they are not knocked on the head at once, before they reach Admiral Baldwin's age. Nay, Sir Walter, cried Mrs. Clay, this is being severe indeed. Have a little mercy on the poor men. We are not all born to be handsome. The sea is no beautifier, certainly. Sailors do grow old betimes, I have observed it. They soon lose the look of youth. But then, is not it the same with many other professions, perhaps most others? Soldiers in active service are not at all better off. And even in the quieter professions there is a toil and a labour of the mind, if not of the body, which seldom leaves a man's looks to the natural effect of time. The lawyer plods, quite careworn, the physician is up at all hours and travelling in all weather, and even the clergyman, she stopped a moment to consider what might do for the clergyman, and even the clergyman, you know, is obliged to go into infected rooms and expose his health and looks to all the injury of a poisonous atmosphere. In fact, as I have been long convinced, though every profession is necessary and honourable in its turn, it is only the lot of those who are not obliged to follow any, who can live in a regular way, in the country, choosing their own hours, following their own pursuits, and living on their own property without the torment of trying for more. It is only their lot, I say, to hold the blessings of health and a good appearance to the utmost. I know no other set of men but what lose something of their personableness when they cease to be quite young. It seemed as if Mr. Shepherd, in this anxiety to bespeak Sir Walter's goodwill towards a naval officer as tenant, had been gifted with foresight, for the very first application for the house was from an Admiral Croft, with whom he shortly afterwards fell into company in attending the quarter sessions at Taunton. And indeed he had received a hint of the Admiral from a London correspondent. By the report which he hastened over to Kellynch to make, Admiral Croft was a native of Somersetshire, who, having acquired a very handsome fortune, was wishing to settle in his own country, and had come down to Taunton in order to look at some advertised places in that immediate neighbourhood, which, however, had not suited him. That accidentally hearing, it was just as he had foretold, Mr. Shepherd observed, Sir Walter's concerns could not be kept a secret. Accidentally hearing of the possibility of Kellynch Hall being to let, and understanding his, Mr. Shepherd's, connection with the owner, he had introduced himself to him in order to make particular inquiries, and had, in the course of a pretty long conference, expressed as strong an inclination for the place as a man who knew it only by description could feel. And given Mr. Shepherd, in his explicit account of himself, every proof of his being a most responsible, eligible tenant. "And who is this Admiral Croft?" was Sir Walter's cold, suspicious inquiry. Mr. Shepherd answered for his being of a gentleman's family, and mentioned a place. And Anne, after the little pause which followed, added, "He is a rear admiral of the White. He was in the Trafalgar action, and has been in the East Indies since. He was stationed there, I believe, several years." "Then I take it for granted," observed Sir Walter, "that his face is about as orange as the cuffs and capes of my livery." Mr. Shepherd hastened to assure him that Admiral Croft was a very hale, hearty, well-looking man, a little weather-beaten, to be sure, but not much, and quite the gentleman in all his notions and behaviour, not likely to make the smallest difficulty about terms, only wanted a comfortable home and to get into it as soon as possible, knew he must pay for his convenience, knew what rent a ready-furnished house of that consequence might fetch, should not have been surprised if Sir Walter had asked more, had inquired about the manor, would be glad of the deputation, certainly, but made no great point of it. Said he sometimes took out a gun, but never killed. Quite the gentleman. Mr. Shepherd was eloquent on the subject, pointing out all the circumstances of the Admiral's family, which made him particularly desirable as a tenant. He was a married man, and without children, the very state to be wished for. A house was never taken good care of, Mr. Shepherd observed, without a lady. He did not know where the furniture might not be in danger of suffering as much where there was no lady as where there were many children. A lady without a family was the very best preserver of furniture in the world. He had seen Mrs. Croft, too. She was at Taunton with the Admiral, and had been present almost all the time they were talking the matter over. "And a very well-spoken, genteel, shrewd lady she seemed to be," continued he, "asked more questions about the house, and terms, and taxes, than the Admiral himself, and seemed more conversant with business. And moreover, Sir Walter, I found she was not quite unconnected in this country, any more than her husband. That is to say, she is sister to a gentleman who did live amongst us once. She told me so herself. Sister to the gentleman who lived a few years back at Monkford. Bless me, what was his name? At this moment I cannot recollect his name, though I have heard it so lately. Penelope, my dear, can you help me to the name of the gentleman who lived at Monkford, Mrs. Croft's brother?" But Mrs. Clay was talking so eagerly with Miss Elliot that she did not hear the appeal. "I have no conception whom you can mean, Shepherd. I remember no gentleman resident at Monkford since the time of old Governor Trent." "Bless me, how very odd! I shall forget my own name soon, I suppose. A name that I am so very well acquainted with. Knew the gentleman so well by sight, seen him 100 times. Came to consult me once, I remember, about a trespass of one of his neighbours. Farmer's man, breaking into his orchard. Wall torn down, apples stolen, caught in the fact. And afterwards, contrary to my judgment, submitted to an amicable compromise. Very odd indeed." After waiting another moment, "You mean Mr. Wentworth, I suppose," said Anne. Mr. Shepherd was all gratitude. "Wentworth was the very name. Mr. Wentworth was the very man. He had the curacy of Monkford, you know, Sir Walter, some time back, for 2 or 3 years. Came there about the year 5, I take it. You remember him, I am sure." "Wentworth? Oh, aye, Mr. Wentworth, the curate of Monkford. You misled me by the term gentleman. I thought you were speaking of some man of property. Mr. Wentworth was nobody, I remember. Quite unconnected, nothing to do with the Strafford family. One wonders how the names of many of our nobility become so common." As Mr. Shepherd perceived that this connection of the Crofts did them no service with Sir Walter, he mentioned it no more, returning with all his zeal to dwell on the circumstances more indisputably in their favour, their age and number and fortune, the high idea they had formed of Kellynch Hall, and extreme solicitude for the advantage of renting it, making it appear as if they ranked nothing beyond the happiness of being the tenants of Sir Walter Elliot. An extraordinary taste, certainly, could they have been supposed in the secret of Sir Walter's estimate of the dues of a tenant. It succeeded, however, and though Sir Walter must ever look with an evil eye on anyone intending to inhabit that house, and think them infinitely too well off in being permitted to rent it on the highest terms, he was talked into allowing Mr. Shepherd to proceed in the treaty, and authorizing him to wait on Admiral Croft, who still remained at Taunton, and fix a day for the house being seen. Sir Walter was not very wise, but still, he had experience enough of the world to feel that a more unobjectionable tenant in all essentials than Admiral Croft bid fair to be could hardly offer. So far went his understanding, and his vanity supplied a little additional soothing in the Admiral's situation in life, which was just high enough and not too high. "I have let my house to Admiral Croft," would sound extremely well, very much better than to any mere Mr. A Mr., save perhaps some half dozen in the nation, always needs a note of explanation. An Admiral speaks of his own consequence, and at the same time can never make a baronet look small. In all their dealings and intercourse, Sir Walter Elliot must ever have the precedence. Nothing could be done without a reference to Elizabeth. But her inclination was growing so strong for a removal that she was happy to have it fixed and expedited by a tenant at hand, and not a word to suspend decision was uttered by her. Mr. Shepherd was completely empowered to act, and no sooner had such an end been reached than Anne, who had been a most attentive listener to the whole, left the room to seek the comfort of cool air for her flushed cheeks, and as she walked along a favourite grove, said with a gentle sigh, "A few months more, and he, perhaps, may be walking here." End of chapter 3.
You probably noticed that for today's episode, I left the LibriVox opening in on the audio that we're using. That's because I have put a link on the show notes. LibriVox is in some trouble. You know, they provide all of this audio and all of these books for free. And it's not just in English. They have many, many different languages represented there, and things like the Magna Carta and all sorts of stuff that you may never have read before, but that we probably should. So it's all just sitting there waiting for us, free, and it's all done by volunteers. And most of you already know this, but, you know, it does cost something to be able to just get the right software and run the servers and all that kind of stuff. As a consequence, LibriVox is doing a fundraising campaign, much like NPR. You know, they're not in your face about it, but they're really hoping that we'll get the word out that they need some financial backup. And I just wanted to put the word out to you. If you can take the link from my blog and put it onto your blogs or your show notes or in your Twitter feed, anything to alert people to the fact that help is needed and for a very good cause, I think. It's kind of like Project Gutenberg, you know? This is the audio version of it, and I respect what they do a lot. I also respect that they give you more than one version of a story, so that if you've heard something read and you didn't really like the way it was read, go ahead and read your own version and they'll upload it. There are 5 versions of Persuasion, which I listened to, all of them. And they weren't bad, but this was the one that I picked because I think she got some of the characters really, really well. And there you are. So, I know this was a long episode. Thank you for hanging in with me while we got through the first 3 chapters. I think you'll be glad that you did. We'll talk a little bit more about Anne next week because she is, at this point, I think, kind of an enigma. She is not Elizabeth Bennet. And Jane Austen is not a young kid anymore when she's writing this book. And I think you can kind of feel that the weight has shifted in her writing. And you're going to see more and more of that as we continue this book. So I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope you stick around. And next week, we will have a new incentive. We will name the incentive winner for the month of February, and I'll be back with more Persuasion. Have a great one. I'll talk to you soon. Bye. Please remember to support the people who support Craftlit. Visit Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. And please visit the blogs and sites of Craftlit supporters. Those links can be found in the sidebar of the show notes. The show notes can be found at craftlit.com. Craftlit can also be accessed by its own iPhone application. You can purchase it at the iPhone or iTouch application store, or you can subscribe free at iTunes. Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.